and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbo's most pop yellow work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are here to talk about some more chapters of this this here darn online book. But before we get to it, a quick reminder. Well, kind of. The fan art contest has just closed, which means voting is about to open. If you're listening to this right as it comes out, chill out for a bit. Just wait for like a day or two, and then the voting will be opened. But yeah, the voting for the fan art contest will be open in a few days, and you can cast your votes, and you can vote for which piece of fan art you like the most, if you're a patron.
Yes. So, you know, that's the way to get an early look at them, and put down which one you think's the best.
Yeah. Should we get into the show, Elliot? False Moves 12.9.
Well, hold on. Before we do, I just did have another announcement, because assuming my math is correct, I just wanted to say that this episode marks the point where Pale Reflections has gone on for longer than Deep Impact.
What?
Which also means that Pale has now officially gone longer than Pact did, because both shows went on the same schedule.
It was already longer in terms of words.
Yes. So, yeah, we're talking number of days.
In terms of time it spans, yes.
Yes. Yeah, Pale is already like 1.5 times the length in words, but it has now also been written over a longer period of time. Or I think that maybe gets a little bit fuzzy because Wildbo did like the sample chapters for Pact, but so I'm going off like published dates here. Yeah.
The first actual, you know, date.
Yeah, when when Pact first went up as like the story Wildbo was going to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or anyway, at the very least, Pale Reflections is now older than Deep Impact in terms of.
Happy birthday? No. Is there a thing? I don't know if there's
I don't think there's a holiday for that. Get on it, presidents.
Yep. All right. Well, let's get on with the show. So we're talking about False Moves 12.9 and 12.10 here this week. Starting with 12.9, obviously. We're in Verona's head. Verona and the gang are hanging out in a record store. Zed indignantly fixes a record player while they chit-chat.
Zed is such a fucking, like, IT student, like, computer science engineering student. Like, just the idea that he goes into this store, sees a broken record player and, like, nobody trying to fix it, and he's just legitimately outraged by this and has the tools on him to fix it. I definitely have a few friends of mine from, like, high school and college that I'm picturing who absolutely fit that bill, like, would have done the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny that Zed's response to this is, all right, I'll fix this for you. Fine.
Yeah, he can't, like, you could tell he can't help it. Like, he can't stand the idea that it's broken and it's fixable and nobody's doing that. Which is, like, actually a very admirable trait, and this is just one of the funniest ways that it can come out. especially because he's right. It's a super simple fix. He just, like, cleans dust off the knob and, like, tightens a screw. It was like a 2-second job.
Yeah, but it's the knowledge of how to fix it, I suppose.
Yeah, because nobody working in a record store should have that knowledge of how to tighten the screw of the arm and clear dust off the air. Like, it feels like it's such a basic thing for this store to have done. And it just, like, it really gets to what he starts to talk about next, which is just, like, he's kind of baffled that this guy could work in this store for so long and just not give a shit at all.
Yeah. And I think that speaks to, like, Zed as a person is clearly very, like, clearly just gives a lot of a shit about the way that they spend their time and kind of can't comprehend people who wouldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, Verona brings up this great thing about, like, momentum, which is something I've definitely been thinking about a lot in my personal life. I guess in part coming out of like 2020 and realizing that like I had lost a lot of momentum in using my time well. So that sort of felt very on point to me with like, Zed sort of being that kind of person who, like does things. And it's like, it's frustrating when you see these other people who just are not doing that.
Can we talk about this stakeout as well? Cause they're staking out the witch hunters, basically just watching them.
Why?
Yeah, I mean, I get why in the sense of gathering information, but it really didn't feel like they were doing this in the best possible way. Like,
no,
and maybe it's just because we know it's going to go wrong it almost goes very wrong, but like they're pretty close to the witch hunters. They don't really have a way out if they get spotted, and they're not even paying that much attention. Like they have somebody keeping watch, but it's just like not, I don't know. It just didn't seem like it was a very good idea.
Yeah. Well, like, cause you mentioned that maybe it's just cause we know how it's going to go, but I can assure you my first time reading this, the whole time was sort of going here. I'm like, but like, why are they here? Cause obviously yeah, you're right. They have Guillemet actually keeping watch. And so I was just sitting here going, so what are the rest of them here for? Like, if you want somebody spying on them, Guillemet's fine. He's probably better off on his own. Like, so what are the rest of them doing here? And yeah, now having read it twice, I still don't quite understand what their plan was, because I was like, oh, maybe they want to try and talk to them. That doesn't really happen. Yeah, I don't know. Like, this to me feels like our lead into, obviously Zed's going to start talking about like strategies and priorities as we get into this, and like this felt like the lead into that for me. It's like these guys are all just sitting here, you know,
not chatting, having any strategy.
Yeah. And like this is part of why Zed's like, hey, so listen, while we're here,
why are we here
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I also really liked something I really liked in this was when Zed's talking about Nina the librarian animus, and yeah, mentions what life is like as a librarian animus. Basically, their life is, here's the quote, "For a librarian animus, life is defined by the search for books, visits to bookstores, meeting people in a moment and giving them that one perfect book." And I was just like, damn, that sounds so fun.
Yeah. Like, especially, you know, it immediately draws comparisons to John, which we'll also talk about. But yeah, like, definitely, if you had to pick John or Nina's life, like, even with Nina being bound by Zed, I'd still probably go for hers.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Like that. I'm sure there are more problems with it, but it's definitely easy to romanticize that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds fun. It sounds like a real fantasy life.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not. This is the other verse.
Yeah, true.
There's some catch we haven't thought of.
Yeah.
Well, Lucy brings up, like, oh, I wonder how that works for John. And I thought that was, like, actually a really interesting question, because you'd almost think, like, as the animus of a soldier, you'd expect him to be all about violence and, like, looking for fights. And, you know, like, her equivalent of giving someone that perfect book, like, John's would be giving them that perfect bullet sort of thing. But that's not him at all. In fact, he kind of has, by and large, gone out of his way to avoid violence.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that the part of a soldier he seems to identify with the most is the desire to get home. Like, that's just such a unique take on the concept of what is important about a soldier. Yeah. And maybe it's, I mean, I don't know, like in films we see that a lot. Like, that's always the driving motivation for the soldier type, right? But yeah, I don't know. I think you're right. He's so interesting in that way.
Well, yeah, because like he will fight without hesitation to protect, you know, like a canneteer or something. Like he's not one to like run away from a fight, but it's just, you know, you hear about Nina, the librarian animus, and she's going out looking for books. She's looking for people to give books. John is not looking for violence. He will get violent if, you know, it's going to help him solve a problem, but he's not like running around looking for fights. He's retreated to the middle of like fucking nowhere and is, you know, trying to play Pokemon on his Game Boy and like sing bad songs. You're right. It's such a great, like, interesting angle, because as an animus of a soldier, in a way, it's like John is kind of a commentary on the ideas of soldiers at large. Like, so it's super interesting to see this like exploration of the take of a soldier who isn't like about the fight, but like will fight if necessary, but doesn't want that to keep happening.
Yeah.
See that a lot in stories. Like that's a thing that comes up in like a lot of stories, is the sort of thing of like, you know, oh, if you keep starting fights or, you know, fighting for things, that just creates more violence. And I think John is an interesting angle of exploring that, in that he's like, he's trying to escape a cycle of violence, but he's not sure how to do that.
Yeah. What a character. I mean, there's a reason he's one of my favorite characters in this. He's just so interesting. Jessica comes inside and Zed, Verona, and Jessica keep talking about the practice, technomancy, and just kind of general planning for a while.
Yeah, and we get this like mini lecture on technomancy at large, which was like very fun. I mean, I love, again, just to comment on Zed as a character, he's that kind of teacher where you can really feel how super enthusiastic and like passionate they are about this topic, because they keep going off topic because they want to bring in everything they can. Like, I definitely had a few university professors, again, that jumped to mind as like someone who was like, I really love this subject, but like, please, could we talk about what we're meant to be learning today?
what a great character. Yeah, he's just so into the subject matter, right? Like, he just has to, every time an interesting question comes up, he needs to answer it in enough depth.
Yeah. And like, we'll be talking about Guillaume later, but there's definitely this little side of him that just like keeps bringing up, oh, and this practice relates to this practice. Like, he loves all these concepts so much that he can't help but like also throw in this other fact. Actually, as I'm saying this, I realize I do that a lot on this podcast. It's something I've been trying to get better about doing. But yeah, it's really encouraging and like exciting. Like, it helps you get into this lecture on what is, a very dry subject from the sounds of it. It's like using fucking power lines to build fake rooms.
It's interesting stuff, isn't it? I really enjoyed finding out about the way that, you know, the lines are already there. You're just choosing which ones to employ as a technomancer. The vibe of it, like, you know, the style of it is very fun.
Yeah, because I think we knew a lot of like this stuff big picture, but there was really some implementation details we learned for the first time. Like, yeah, well, I really love the focus on like how the spirits are kind of new. So they're, in a way, they're almost more manipulable, but then also they're not really powerful. So you've got to kind of like lean on not cutting edge stuff to give them like an idea of what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
It does remind me a lot of like people doing tinkering or like hacking with very new hardware, like that sort of thing where you can, it's going to take a ton of effort because there's not really much support, and like, you know, you everything's new, and if it breaks, there's not really any support. But when you get like, you know, a fucking little Arduino thing you made to do something, like you feel like a fucking god. Like, yeah, it actually doesn't do anything that cool, but like you love it because you made it. And that's sort of the vibe I get from technomancy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's really, you can really do some crazy stuff, but you kind of have to figure it out.
Yeah. I love this this rule Ray has sort of created that comes back, which is like, well, it's going to be weak, fragile, or short. It's like you got to pick two. Again, just another angle of the practice that could be an entire magic system in another series.
Yeah, 100%. Something that I thought was really cool in this section that I didn't realize until the reread is there's a moment in here where Zed takes the opportunity to let us know like how comfortable he is being against Musa and between the Witch Hunters and Musa. And given that this is going to come up in the next chapter, I thought this was really interesting. Zed basically talks about like how involved against Musa he's willing to be, e.g. not really at all. I just thought this is a great thing for Wabo to introduce so that, you know, we have an idea of what Zed is comfortable with in isolation before he starts getting pressured by the powers that be to be a bit more active, or, you know, actively inactive, I suppose.
Yeah, well, especially because none of the people in that conversation are in this one. So it's sort of prep for us, and it kind of presumably helps Verona understand what Avery did later. But like, yeah, it's great sort of set up for us as readers, mostly. I get the vibe, yeah. I also really wanted to call out this bit where I think it's during the section where Zed is sort of, you know, telling Verona all this stuff about Musa and how he doesn't really want to take him down because it's going to lead to more conflict outside of Kennet. And he says, oh, actually, no, I think it's Jessica who says, too many power systems in the various families lean on these guys. They might start feeling threatened. And Verona thinks, systems, power systems, families, expectations. And then she sighs. And I was just like, like, that's the other verse, just really bringing the text, like, the subtext out and just being like, hey, here you go, this is what I'm doing. Like, I love these stories just because sometimes they'll just pop their head up and be like, this is the subtext, this is what I'm doing. Do you get it?
Mm. Yeah, it's it's very fun. Verona actively sighing at the explicit subtext of this story. It is very fun.
The other verse, I think I remember saying this towards the end of Deep Impact, but like, one of my favorite things about it is it's really just the text and the subtext, like, having sex. Mm-hmm. And this is a great moment for that, because like, we're getting all this stuff in the context of this fight. And this is the story very much saying, yeah, but this prioritization and like organization stuff that Verona needs is really going to start to fix some of her home problems.
This priority stuff that gets framed is like interesting. It feels really like something that Verona needs. Like,
yeah,
thinking about this really made me think of her interactions with Jeremy and how like she knows kind of what she wants and she's got it all sorted out in her head, and so she's kind of just trusting that it will more or less work out. It feels like a very like, oh, it'll be all right kind of vibe, right? The Australian she'll be right attitude. And yeah, that's a problem when there's almost certainly going to have to be some tough decisions being made here that she's just not ready for. And I think it's great that Zed says this to her, and she starts to internalize it later on in this very chapter.
Yeah, that's a great pull. I hadn't actually connected it to Jeremy, but I think you're right, because for me, part of the missing piece of like her and Jeremy's relationship has sort of been like a where do you see this going, or like, what do you want this to be? Like, she's very happy with it kind of right now, and so she's just sitting on it and then kind of getting angry when people try to tell her that maybe it's not all good. It also reminds me of like her plan to turn into an other. We've criticized that plan 100 times for like lacking that one part of the plan, which is what do you actually want to achieve out of this? Like, she just kind of latched onto the fact she didn't like her humanity, and so she was like, oh, well, then I need to be not human. And there wasn't really strategy behind that plan.
Mm-hmm.
Is sort of the vibe I get. So yeah, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Again, this was one of those moments where like I was reminded why Verona's my favorite, because I very much related to this whole thing. I definitely fall in the same trap. It's the same reason, like, you know, the reason I keep yelling at her about Jeremy is because I've been in a similar-ish situation, mm-hmm. and regret decisions I didn't make at the time. So it's like, yeah, I just love these moments where like this character's sort of getting advice and I'm reading it and going, shit, that is a good point, Zed. Like, just fucking at me.
Yeah. I agreed with this. I had this same thought of like it hitting close to home. The Verona's casual attitude really coming up. I mean, in my defense, I'm not faced with situations that often where I have to pick like, am I going to save my town or let my friend die kind of stuff.
That's the point of a story like this, is you apply the same principles to outlandish situations to kind of, you know, it's all in the subtext.
True. But yeah, you're right. It's just a very cool moment for sure.
Also, I do just have to call out that Zed is the one talking to her about making sure she's got her strategies and her priorities. Not 2 minutes before this, he took a break to fix a record player. Mm-hmm. So like, Zed, you're right, and I love you, but also you are still working on this yourself, clearly, because you just took a break from watching The Witch Hunters to fix a record player.
Yeah. Yeah. Heal thyself first, I guess.
I mean, I think he admittedly says like he's working on it. Like, it's something that doesn't come quite naturally to him.
Mm.
Which I mean, I know this feels like one of those things that you're always, I'm still working on it. Like, the way Verona keeps having to like list out all the priorities as she's like in this fight was very relatable. I'm doing that all throughout the day, all the time, having to like mentally remind myself of everything I have to do today. Otherwise, I
make your mental list of things.
Yeah.
So yeah, Cleo returns to the Witch Hunters group, and they use that as their opportunity to attack. They move in on the record store and a fight breaks out with the Witch Hunters. I mean, pretty definitively winning this engagement, right?
Yeah, which, like, again, I'm just coming back to, like, was there even a plan here from the Kennett side beyond just keep an eye on them as a massive, very obvious group?
Yeah.
Or, because I guess the other thing here, there's not really any effort taken to talk to them as they approach, which seemed quite un-Kennettier to me. Like, they just sort of immediately enter battle stations, which I think is the right call, but it, again, just made me ask, well, if they weren't here to talk to them, what were they here to do?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my gut is just gather intel, but there has to have been a better way to have done this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's this bit where, as things go to shit, Frenna's stuck in the store, and obviously she's gainsaid, right? So she doesn't have most of her usual tricks, and it's just terrifying. Like, I don't think Verona has some moments where she kind of pauses for a moment, but I don't feel like she ever really fully processes how close to being murdered she gets here.
Yeah, there's one part where she's thinking on her options, and she thinks, no, calling John with the dog tags is for emergencies. And I was like, there's a woman standing over you with a chainsaw.
With a chainsaw, yeah.
What the
and
fuck
And you don't
you
have your
this?
Powers. Like, what are you talking about, Verona? You almost get murdered here.
Oh, she also thinks, oh, I shouldn't use the dog tags because Lucy might need him, which is a better argument. But, like, she kind of ends the thought on John is for emergencies. And I read that and I was like, what do you call this then? Like, what do you want about? And something else that comes up here is Harris, our super smell witch hunter, mentions a couple of times how Verona doesn't smell like as scared as she should. Mm-hmm. And it was a thread that jumped into my mind quite immediately because obviously, like, Verona had just been chatting to Jessica and we hadn't really seen these two interact since Jessica had made that comment right at the end of, like, Arc 7. That was sort of like where she told Avery that Verona scared her a little bit with how she was handling the stress. And so then, like, watching Verona sort of try to make friends with Jessica, I was kind of thinking in the back of my mind already, oh, is Jessica still holding on to this, like, read of Verona that she doesn't quite trust her? And then for the story to then just sort of cut to Harris being like, she's not afraid like she should be. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know where this topic is going, but, like, I it's just such an interesting facet of Verona. Like, she shares a bit of that ability a lot of, like, toxic people have, which is to just shelve her emotions. And so it's like, I get, like, maybe we're exploring what does that look like in someone who is good. Like, how can you use that ability well? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that Harris smells that, and his thought is, and seemingly his and Elisa's thought is something along the lines of, she is augmented in a way that means that she doesn't feel emotions. And Verona doesn't seem to question this much, if at all. Because this isn't, unless I'm misunderstanding, this wasn't like a remnant of the alchemical mix that she ingested with the Marisica fight or anything. This was just her, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Like, now that you're saying that, I can see. So I read Elise and Harris's comments as just, oh, she's one of those psycho practitioners who can pack away her emotions. Not like
I see.
She was using magic, but, like, now that you've said that, I'm kind of like, it could easily be either, both. I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But yeah, like, I kind of just read it as, yeah, them just thinking, you know, yeah, she's like one of those, you know, Alexander types who can just shovel away her emotion. Obviously, we've seen that, you know, Verona doesn't have a perfect track record of being able to do that, obviously, but I don't know, this sort of very subtle thread that keeps popping up every now and then in the story is like, you know, Verona handles these emotions in her own way, and, you know, how, you know, some people are concerned by that or whatever, and I'm just interested to see what it ends up looking like.
Hey, so also, there's a bit here where Guillaume is just watching as Verona is getting attacked. It's the specific line is, Guillaume was standing back there watching without intervening. And Guillaume gets into a fight with Harris in a bit, but right now, he's just standing there. And it feels to me like he's doing his mentor thing, like letting Verona struggle in the pursuit of learning whatever lesson. Again, Verona comes very close to death here. And so now it makes me feel like Guillaume's fall to winter, he's going to keep playing out this pattern and just let people keep fighting their own battles, in air quotes. But I think it's going to happen that he's going to think somebody is in a position to learn something and actually they're going to get seriously injured.
Yeah, his judgment calls on this stuff do seem to be getting worse. We'll obviously talk about that a lot. But yeah, I feel like the best case scenario read on this is he was waiting for the perfect time to strike, which leans into the same problems you were just talking about his ability to judge that anymore. But yeah, there's also the chance that, you know, additionally, because he is a fairy, there's always more than one thing going on. He did want her to get as much experience on her own as she could. That said, thank God he was here because he distracts Harris throughout this, which is very valuable. Yes.
And also sounds like saves Verona's life.
Yeah, and it sounds like the coolest fucking fight happening in the background too. Like, we keep getting cuts to like old man Guillaume fucking going toe to toe with this experienced witch hunter. It's very fun.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, it's good stuff. Oh, and then the whole thing that we're looking forward to with these witch hunter showdowns is a bit of the old conflicting ideologies. And Verona gets a few seeds of that in here against Elise, which is nice. The quote that I put out is Elise saying, "I'm having a harder and harder time telling myself that maybe you're one of the ones we can suffer to live." And Verona's response is, "If you say that kind of stuff, you're automatically the bad guy," which is great. I think that's very fun. I like sowing the seeds of doubt in the minds of the witch hunters is definitely good. And I'm just, eager to see how it goes.
Yeah, although the witch hunters are making it clear that it's going to be a bit harder than it has been in the past. Like, I feel like some villains in this story, it's sort of been one well-timed, well-said, speech by a Kenneteer has kind of turned them, with lead up before that or whatever. But like with the witch hunters, at least very quickly establishes everyone tries to tell us like why what they're doing is okay and justify themselves.
Yes.
And like we just don't listen. It's sort of, she doesn't say that, but she says that.
Yeah. I think it's a fair point by Elise. Like, of course every single monster they've killed has tried to justify itself.
Yeah. I mean, so, that's what this story has been like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Shoving down our throats is, yeah, everyone sort of has their motivation.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the thing. Like, if you think about it, like if, say, the witch hunters put down their weapons and they're like, okay, just tell us what you're doing, what's going on, and we'll hear you out. What's your plan? Like, the Kennet tears and the Kennet others would sort of have to be like, okay, so what we want to do is let this almighty violence power keep stewing here for a week or so. Then hopefully the nice monsters will beat the bad monsters that are probably going to come back. And we can put someone in this super powerful position over the
I don't think
area.
They would say that. What they would say is, we're trying to solve a murder and people keep getting in the way of that.
I guess my point is that I don't necessarily think that transparency is on Kennet's side when it comes to the witch hunters. I feel like the more the witch hunters learn about the situation, the more the witch hunters are not going to give up.
Yeah.
With some stuff, like I'm not saying they won't be convinced. Like there could be a way forward that, like, where they get the right pieces of information, the right order, and come to an understanding, like Elise's mum sort of did. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely a lot of facts that are very core to this Carmine conspiracy that are going to make the witch hunters go, "No, we're not going to let you do that."
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this situation has obviously gotten a bit beyond their capability anyway, so. Having the witch hunters come in as the adults to solve the situation is not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can make the argument that this is sort of exactly what the witch hunters exist for, is situations like this that are, let's be fair, completely out of control.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot to this, like, Elise debate stuff that was very fun. Like, Elise brings up this great point that, the worst things aren't actually the super scary others. It's, you know, she basically says the Mosses and the Alexanders and the Bristows. Like, it's the people who have this power and are using it poorly that are the problem. And that makes sense coming from Elise, because we learned about her dad last week. But what I love about that is, like, that is 100% Kennet's position too.
Mm.
And like, this is just like the best kind of conflict in a story like this, is that, like, really, these guys are on the same side. Like, they're both trying to stop the same sort of people. They just,
yes,
have both kind of put each other in the way in the meantime. Like, and yeah, this is why we want them to be on the same team, because we know that at the end of the day, they kind of stand for the same stuff. They just, because of like the Witch Hunter's past trauma and some other stuff, they're not, it's going to take a lot to get them on that same page where they will realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that comes up a little bit when Verona mentions, like, oh, hey, Musa might be the kind of practitioner that you are referring to by this kind of thing. But yeah, that beat can be hit a lot harder.
Yeah. And especially because the Witch Hunters, you know, they know that Fairy are on Team Kennet. Like, they're not going to let them try to use tricky words to get out of it. Like, I think the Witch Hunters are responding fairly to the team that has Fairy on it, which is just shoot first, ask questions later.
Yeah.
Like, we just saw the Kenneteers essentially try to do that to Marisica. So it seems unfair to, like, come down on the Witch Hunters for not giving them a chance when they just sort of did the same thing themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
I did just want to say as well, something I really like about this section is, so there's obviously, like, mirrors between the two fights going on here. Like, obviously we have, like, Guillaume, the old other, fighting the old Witch Hunter. And then Elise, you know, with the shit dad, kind of maps to Verona, and they're both like using their own magically enhanced items. but I feel like the reason Verona gets out of this, and the reason she kind of comes out on top, isn't directly because of the magical item she had on her, the keyboard, but it's the fact that when the gremlins come out of it, she has that moment with the one with the screws in its mouth where she's like, hey, like, you can be better. And it's sort of like, whereas Elise's response to the gremlins that attack her is she just fights back. Verona has one attacking her and she's like, hey, you can be better, you know, go drop some mad tunes. And like, that to me is what actually gives her the edge. And I just really like that like, what kind of wins this for Verona is she is the one who doesn't just go for violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 You're right. It's good. It's a good marker of a differentiation between her and, like, Elise, right? Is, her survival in this scene is tied to her connections, not her weapon of sorts.
Yeah. Well, Elise has taken what her dad did to her and turned it into like, a lot of violence. Like, I'm going to be interested to see more of these comparisons between Elise and Verona, because Elise is someone who's also been labeled as, like, when she enters fight mode, the, you know, softer part of her falls away. Like, that kind of sounds like Verona too. So I feel like there's going to be more to explore, like, comparing and contrasting these two. And I can't wait, because, yeah, this is a great little first foray, which is Verona accepts help, and that's why she gets out. Also, yeah, this scene is more evidence that we need the visual version of Pale, because I need to see, like, Guillaume and Harris doing this, like, epic fucking fight scene in a record store while this little gremlin wearing earwax headphones is playing, like, distorted children's songs. Like, think about how good the,
it's a good
the musical
scene setting, isn't it?
Yeah, think about how good the musical settings are in, like, Umbrella Academy. This is going to be, like, way better than that.
Oh, yeah. The soundtrack to the Pale, you know, TV show adaptation is going to be delightful for this scene, for sure. One other thing to note is, yeah, we mentioned this bit of Elise saying, I'm having a harder and harder time telling myself that maybe you're one of the ones we can suffer to live. As she comes in swinging with a chainsaw, which is just interesting to stop and think, like, wait, Elise, how do you, is this what you do when you decide someone deserves to live? You come in with a chainsaw? Like, it just kind of seems crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I'm coming back to the whole, like, there was no discussion before this that everyone came in swinging, and there's almost, it's very shoot first, ask questions later, or in Elise's case, like ring, ding, ding, ding first, and then ask questions. I guess it's like that thing, you know, if all you've got is a hammer, everything's a nail. Like, if your thing is impractical weapons, then everything is an impractical fight.
Yeah, fair enough. She's if the tool she has is a chainsaw, you're right that she's got to come in using her chainsaw at least somewhat.
yeah, like I can't blame her too much because she's coming to fight like practitioners and others. It's sort of like a self-defense thing in a way, you know. Perhaps like a first strike sort of defense, but yeah, I can't blame her for going into the confrontation ready to you know, defend herself at the very least.
Verona and Guillaume get out of this situation, and the Kenneteers chat more to Guillaume. He admits to sending in Raph, but doesn't really seem to be able to give any good explanations. And obviously the Kenneteers think his fall to winter has already progressed to the point where he is just going to be basically endlessly plotting for no real reason, no purpose that he can explain.
Yeah, like there's definitely a almost a bit of a like sundowning vibe to Guillaume here. Like, you know, he's been wearing the guise of an old man this whole chapter, which again, sometimes the other verse isn't subtle. Yeah,
that's very good.
There's this great moment where like obviously it's played for comedy a bit, where how he keeps sort of like, they keep being like, okay, summarize it. And he's like, yep, sure. 615 years ago in the fall court. There's this great bit where he brings up where him and some of his drunk mates were like wooing women from another court. And Verona asks, like, oh, are these allegories for Marissica? And Guillaume's like, no, they're not an allegory for anything in particular here. And, like, Lucy just makes this frustrated sound.
Yeah, I mean, like, he must... there's a small shadow of a doubt that he is still just Guillaume at the start of this scene. But that, when he says that, you're just like, Guillaume, how can you not see this? Like, yeah.
Yeah, and I think like this is a chapter that talks a lot about, you know, Verona's ability to prioritize and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is why this is in this chapter, because Guillaume is almost showing us what happens when you lose that ability. I feel like what we're seeing here is somebody who's very good, very clever, very experienced. But even after all that, as he's approaching the end of his life, I feel like what he's lost right here is that ability to prioritize. And that's why we keep having these conversations with him, they're going nowhere, and everyone has to cut him off because he just ends up talking about bullshit that doesn't matter. And it's such like a cool little thread that, like, as Verona is starting to think about, oh, maybe I need to do this, we kind of see Guillaume as this example of how even if you have everything else going for you, if you can't do this prioritization, you're kind of useless.
Yeah, like if he just doesn't, yeah, he just can't seem to comprehend that he's just kind of running in circles, and it's tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super sad. And I'm dreading seeing where he ends up at the end of the story, because I just don't see it being good at this point. And yeah, it sucks.
Yeah.
Especially because if you think back to like the start of the story, he was very good and capable. Like, if anything, if there isn't a sort of turning point, I think it would be when Daniel took that note from him and cut out one of his like two remaining stories, so he you know, when he halved them. But I like this idea that almost like for Fairy, you know, everything's very long term, big scales with them. So if this was like a gradual change to winter, I feel like that would be something Fairy would understand better. Whereas if he's actually deteriorating quite quickly, you know, these are the people who miss the trees for the forest. Like, Guillaume may not be appreciating his deterioration because it's happening quickly. And he's fucking thousands of years old. He's not used to, for want of a better term, biological changes that happen quickly.
Yeah, you're right. It's too fast for him to be able to see it.
Yeah, which is like, because I think for humans, it's almost the opposite. Like, for us, like, you're more likely to notice something like this when it's a bit sudden. Whereas, you know, if you sort of gradually start to develop dementia or whatever, it can take you till you're further along to notice.
Yeah. The most tragic part of this to me is when Verona compares Guillaume to her dad. you feel that insult. Like, Guillaume gets it. It's like,
yeah.
And even so, he just can't, like, he seems incapable to swallow his pride and just like chat to them about this. And it just, the longer that goes on, the longer it goes on where he can't have this conversation with them, clearly the worse it seems, right? The more lost he feels.
Yeah, you're right. The fact that Verona can drop, what might be the sickest burn in this whole fucking story, which is, you remind me of my dad. Aguilome appreciates what that means. And then he still refuses. Like, she's basically like, you remind me of my dad because you're making us the bad guys for trying to work through things. And his response to that is, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, like, there's, I don't know what more they can do. And I think this is when he starts going, what are you going to do? Bind me? Oh, no, this is actually the end of that. It's going to, I'm already super sad about where Guillaume's headed. It's tragic.
Yeah, it's very rough.
And he explicitly reminds us in this section as well, this is his last story. He says, my final story is being this protector and mentor for the Carmine plot. So just in case, I guess you anyone had forgotten, it's like, yes, the deadline of a week from now also applies to Guillaume's fall to winter. When, as everything unveils, I guess, depending on how it goes, we will see what he turns into.
Yeah. Sounds fun. Can't wait. But yeah, so Verona ends this chapter by reaching out to Clem for some magical items, which is a great setup. And I'm just hyped to see, you know, what's going to be in her bag of tricks.
Yeah, I hope she literally just sort of gets a random bag of crap, like, express delivered, and then has to, like, immediately use it in a fight and, like, figure it out what it is on the fly. Like, because I feel like with everything going on in Kedet right now, she's not going to have that day to sit in the house on Half Street and figure out what everything is with, like, Nicolette's diagnosis stuff. She's just going to have to, like, do some real on-the-fly diagnosis and be like, oh, I think this thing shoots fire. Let's find out and, like, throw it, see what happens.
See what,
like,
happens, yep.
I'm kind of hoping she just gets a random bundle of crap that we find out what it does on the fly. That'd be so fun.
We'll have to wait and see. Because unfortunately, that's the end of 12.9. So for 12.10, we're in Avery's head. Avery's going over her notes, putting reasons to each of the new Kennet others and trying to figure out what they each are here for.
Yeah. And obviously, this has been a thread that's come up a number of times in the last few weeks. Like, since, like, Rook dropped it on us about an arc ago. And then since then, it's like every few chapters, we've been reminded this is something we should think about. And then here it's like, yeah, the first like quarter of the chapter almost is dedicated to Avery pondering it, which is suggesting to me that we may not have to wait too long for Marcy to show up and start playing on this, because like this felt like a big refresher, like, you know, almost Wilbur just sort of saying, hey, remember, this is everyone that you need to be thinking about.
I guess it's interesting for us to be reminded of this and kind of think about it as well. We still don't have solid answers for a few people. Rook is one, I think. There's a possible explanation there, but it doesn't feel super satisfying to me. Liz also feels a little bit not fully understood. And then there's Ken, who is basically completely unknown why he's here.
Yeah, I think like the thing that really jumped out to me and sort of becomes a bit of a theme of this chapter was like, right at the start, Avery kind of starts with some of the easy ones and she's like, yeah, you know, like someone like Tashlit. She's like, yeah, obviously, you know, brought in by Verona, she's fine. Probably should put a question mark there though. And I was like, yeah, this is the thing with not just this world, but fucking fairy plots is like, I wouldn't even be comfortable putting down a 100% check next to Sig's name, which is insane because he's a cigarette that's like in jail. And yet I'm still, part of me's like, oh fuck, Marisica could have a plan with him. I don't know. So there's almost a part of me that just wants to say that Avery's going about this all the wrong way. Like, trying to figure out what the plan is futile because Marisica might have a dozen for each one. Like, it's, you're not going to outplan a fairy with this tricky shit. It's just, you know, you got to cut the Gordian knot, I almost feel like, with this. Don't, like, just try and become their friend so it can't work, or, I don't know, sort out contingencies to fully shut each of them down, which feels terrible to say, but they've done it before. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, a part of me almost just thinks trying to compete with Marisica and Wilbo on this is just a futile exercise.
Yes, I kind of agree with that. I mean, like, Avery puts question marks next to a bunch of them, and you're just kind of like, yeah, I mean, they're all question marks, right?
Yeah, the fact that I cannot confidently say there's still not a plan that will involve Sig tells me that I just may as well not play. Like,
yeah,
if I can't trust that the cigarette in jail is out of play, then what? Like, I'm not capable of being in this field.
Yeah, Yeah. Sorry,
that's going to be the really fun thing. Like, if Marisica and Liz and whoever show up and sort of become the fourth team in this conflict, like, when player four enters the game, it's going to be fucking wild, right? Like, because Marisica must have contingencies for, well, she invited the Blue Heron folks. And the Witch Hunters probably won't throw her too much. Like, I can't wait to see. She's going to land with a splash, I think, and it's going to be great.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, we shall see, I suppose. I was trying to rack my brain around Ken and see if I could think of any possible reasons. And, like, the only one I can think of is that the trio seem to really have focused on the house on Half Street as, like, a base for themselves because it's secure. So if there's something about Ken that is like a trap in the sense that, you know, the places that he's made for them aren't secure, I could see that being it, but I really don't have anything else about it.
Yeah, well, because the Kenneteers have talked about that and they seem to think the answer is they're fine,
actually. Yeah, exactly.
The best I can think that would relate to that is Ken going to pull that whole, no, when I say I really mean me, but not one of my children, or, you know, like everyone kept thinking Edith was doing, but I feel like we've established in the story that that's not how it works. I feel like it's going to be one of Ken's children is the thing. I don't know what or how, presumably one we've already met. So I'm trying to think like how Nettie or KT could be used against the Kenneteers or against Kennet at large. I don't know. Something that jumped out to me as I did try to think about all this was like, there's a lot of combo shit in here, which makes me think that there's like contingencies and shit to the plan, because like, obviously we'll get to Jabba later, but I feel like something we did get told about Ken very early on was like, you can affect him to sort of change the innocence, but it's like super hard to do. And so it's like, maybe if they drain Jabba's batteries to influence like a part of Ken to influence a part of the town, that will do something. You know, I really have this all figured out, as you can tell.
Is there a you know, a Kenling, I guess, that that strikes you as being especially relevant or useful? Like, I'm trying to think what it could be just beyond like demographically, Marisica needs all the, you know, 18 to 22 year olds to come out and support her plan, and that just seems insane to me. So
yeah, I don't know, like maybe Nettie like could be part of it, something to do with like the, you know, I guess if you've got like from memory, Nettie was more about like that poorer part of the neighborhood that had like a drug problem, and it, presumably they're already a little bit more vulnerable to becoming aware. So, you know, if Marisica can use Jabba to use Nettie to push a lot of them much closer to awareness suddenly, that would be bad, probably. There's some missing pieces in that, obviously, but yeah. Liz also strikes me as like another real combo piece on the board, like, because her whole thing, like, we've seen her sort of copy not just like abilities and talents, but like tools. Like, she got a mask when she was the Kenneteers, right? I think we've seen her get like runes that Verona had. Half the people in this conflict right now are predominantly defining themselves by tools they have on them, like Cleo, well, all the Witch Hunters really, but like you know, that's where Verona's going now. Raquel, like, I'm just picturing if Liz showed up in a fight between Verona and Raquel, she could turn into a hybrid of the two of them, who'd basically have like a shitload of tools, because that's what, like, Raquel collects soft implements from memory. So like,
yeah,
like Liz taking the form of Verona and Raquel just makes her as powerful as them. Like that, and that's, and yeah, that's just those two. Like, there's so many people Liz can copy and get a lot of power out of in this conflict.
Yeah, you're right. I quite like that. But I don't know. I mean, I doubt that part of the plan was Liz being around for this specific situation with the Witch Hunters coming in. I mean, I don't know, maybe it is.
Well, I mean, Marisica's essentially the one who called Massa in. So knowing that, you know, the family of implement wielders was coming, you know, or would come.
Yeah, I could see that.
So last bit from this section. One thing Avery quickly does is, like, in her head as she's walking with them, she labels Zed, Bree, and Jess, like our Blue Heron trio, as like definite greens. And I love her little comment about if I can't trust these three, then like what's even the fucking point? Which just rang very true to me. But it made me think back to like, do you remember when we first met Zed and he was like super sus in the way that like he was kind of friendly to the Kenneteers, but like I'm remembering in like 3.x in his interlude, it was like he and Nicolette were both very much like, can't wait for those three new students to arrive. Like if they hadn't befriended Zed and Nicolette, Zed and Nicolette would still be poking around as enemies, presumably. Like it's just funny to think he's been invited here as a friend, and I 100% trust him. Don't read this as any tinfoiling. But I just think it's funny that like he is someone who started as a snooper who we didn't trust and who wouldn't have stopped if they hadn't like invited him in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, pretty much the same with Nico as well, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It is fun, very fun to think back and be like, oh shit, yeah, there was a point at which Zed and Nico were like the big threats that were coming into town.
Well, not just that, like even during the Blue Heron Institute, we kept getting little reminders that were sort of like, yeah, we're friends with these guys, but like they're still very curious about Kennet. Like, honestly, I guess there's a small part of me that thinks like Zed is obviously here because he is Avery's friend and wants to help. But I can't help believe there's also at least a little part of him that is just excited to be meeting the Kennet others and finding out what is going on here. Which isn't like a bad thing, but like, it's funny that like, that was sort of almost one of his defining traits when we first met him was this guy is not going to stop snooping. And we've almost turned him into, hey, come on in.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry. One other thing to mention from this bit before we move on as well, though, on a lighter tone, the family dinner at Jasmine's house with Zed, Bree, and Jessica and Avery's family, like, oh, that's going to be so fun. I want it to be first half of the chapter, Zed, Bree, Jessica, Avery, Verona, Lucy, and they're all just hanging out and having a good time. Then second half of the chapter, Avery's family show up and it turns into a real shit show because that's also going to be delicious to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like the breakfast when Verona came back and it was like originally like Jazz, Sylvia, and the trio. And then we had that moment where like Avery's whole family showed up. And it was hilarious. So yeah, just do that again, except it's a dinner. Yeah, fuck, that'd be good. Especially because now it's the extra dysfunctional half of Avery's family. Like, you can just picture like Connor fucking stumbling through the door half an hour late with like Declan and Kerry in each arm, like crying.
It's gonna be such a mess.
Be the most excited I've been for a dinner party since 7.x of Ward.
The Kennet others come by to talk to Jessica, Bree, and Zed. And to start with, Avery has a conversation with Jabba.
Oh, this got me so good. Like, this was, I was freaking the fuck out when I first started to read this. I was like, wait, he can talk? That makes no sense. I was like, what is going on?
Yeah, it was pretty wild, wasn't it?
Yeah, like half of me was sitting here being like, this doesn't make any sense. But that half was completely silenced by the other half that was just like, oh shit, we've got to see where this is going. And that was so great because I just blatantly read past a bunch of clues. Like, it was great reading this a second time because like there's moments where like Avery's like, oh, Miss and Rook are standing in the background and just smiling weirdly for some reason. And it's just like, yeah, because they're fucking in on the joke. Like, yeah, like just a bunch of clues like that I read past in my panic because I had to see what Jabba had to say because holy shit, Jabba can talk. And this makes no sense, but I have to see it. Like, 10 out of 10 prank. I didn't think goblins were capable of pranks that fucking good.
Yeah.
Especially Cherry Pop.
Yeah, it it was pretty great. Like, it completely got me as well, 1,000,000%. Of course it did. It was just, yeah, very good. I want to, putting aside the hilarious prank for a moment, I think it's interesting that a number of times throughout this, Jabba says the word Bista, right? And I'm like 90% sure that this came up before and we thought he was saying biscuit last time we dove into can we actually understand Jabba. I'm just like, I really think there's a possible way to understand Jabba.
I mean, I went down that road last time. You're welcome to try. I came up with this fucking elaborate theory on how he was saying different saying words in different languages, every word or something. And then it turned out to be apparently not true. So, like, if there is a method to the madness of Jabba's stuff, Walbo's hidden it very well because I can't see it. Mm. I don't know. I think Bistar and, like, Weller might just be shit he says a lot. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah.
Although I think he's been around Biscuit most of the time we've seen him. So, yeah, I don't know. Somebody will crack this shit in, like, 10 years. In, like, a decade, there'll be, like, somebody who finally figures out the code Walbo used.
Yeah, maybe. I kind of think there's a chance that that we will get some big reveal when they finally learn to understand Jabba.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, Avery brings up, like, how could they even try to interview him, and Dreaming's out, so...
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah, like maybe there is some sort of pattern there, but I don't know what it is.
Mm. Yeah. One other fun note. Obviously, as Avery is talking to Jabba, it's actually Biscuit responding, right?
Yeah.
And that makes sense for all of the responses, except there's this one that I pulled out where Biscuit says, "Farts are a matter of mating," and I was just like, wait, on my second read, that one jumped out to me as like, wait, what? Is that true? Like, are farts goblins versions of, like, mating cries?
I mean, just goblins?
What are you saying, Elliot? I'm trying to process this joke in my head, and I can't process it.
I think that's just weird goblin shit. I mean, you know, there's, like, humans into, like, scat and stuff, so, like...
Mm.
Like, farts doesn't seem like a stretch.
Yeah, I guess.
Also,
yeah.
maybe it's not a positive matter of mating. Like, you know, if you know, you and someone else are about to get down and do it dirty and somebody rips a big fart, mm. that could go either way.
Sure, either way, yeah, 100%. Anywho. Yeah. So getting to the real chat between the practitioners and the Kennet others. Miss reveals that the reason they want to talk to them is basically to ask them to let Musa die if it comes to that. and Avery is fairly understandably annoyed that this is what they're asking. But I don't know. I'm undecided on this, I think.
This is a very... I had a lot of fun thinking about this. This is a great little, like, debate.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Like, obviously, it's a pretty horrible thing to have to ask them, but also... they do have to ask them this. Like, I'm pretty sure that Avery pushing back so hard against this is going to cause a problem by the end of this, you know, series of chapters.
Yeah, there's this great moment where I feel like Rook really summarizes the core issue of this debate here, where Avery sort of says to her, like, I saw what Alexander and Bristow did to, like, Lucy and Verona, respectively.
Mm.
Do you want me to have to shoulder that for Musa? Like, are you asking me or Zed or Bree or Jessica to do that, shoulder that responsibility for killing Musa or being mm-hmm. responsible for his death? Because I don't think that's okay. And Rook responds, it may not be okay, but it might be necessary. And if I can turn the question back on you, what does it say about you if you aren't willing to shoulder that responsibility and take someone toxic like him out of the picture?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, fuck, that is... like, I don't know what side I'm on. They both made very good points. I think Avery's right that that's unfair, but I think Rook's right that...
like, life is unfair. You can't just play fair and expect things to all work out, right?
Like, but if we play fair, Musa and Marisica are going to win. Like,
yeah.
I loved reading this because I was flip-flopping based on who spoke last, which is the best kind of debate.
Mm.
I think... I remember Jessica brings up one point. I feel like I was 100% on the same page as Jessica. Jessica has this bit where she's like, honestly, Musa, I'm not like setting out to kill him, but if all you guys who hate him are going to do it, like, okay, is sort of the vibe she gives. But she's like, I kind of draw the line at Raquel and Reed who haven't had that chance yet. And that was very much, I was like, for me to have agreed to this, there would need to be a plan, not necessarily a bulletproof one, admittedly, but like a thing to like get Raquel and Reed and maybe even Y out of there. I thought I really liked that point from Jess. I was like 100% in agreement with that. Like, we can take down Abraham, but like, even Reed is only 19 or something, which, like, if I think about what I was like at 19, based on the environment I was raised in, like, he hasn't had a chance yet.
Yeah. But, you know, the Canadas do acknowledge this and say, like, yeah, we want to get them out of here as much as possible, but we can't be held accountable if they refuse to back down, which, yeah. I mean, is exactly the position that the Canadiers took against, let's say, Bristow, right?
Yeah.
Genuinely try their hardest to avoid what has to be done, but if he refuses, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, but there's almost a difference doing that to the man in charge, like Bristow, versus doing it to Raquel, who is kind of brainwashed by her dad or uncle, in a way. Like, if that makes sense. Like, I get what you're saying, but, like, for me, Raquel and even kind of Reed, I'm not kind of willing to hold them accountable for their actions in this situation here because of the environment they were raised in.
Mm.
It's not fair to expect them to behave the right way because they have no reason to. They haven't been brought up to.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah.
Like, there's the bit where Miss is like, oh, Rook could maybe go and save Raquel. And you could, the text is just like, Rook gave her a glare.
Mm.
Like, just the idea of being like, hey, Rook, would you go save this practitioner who collects implements? Like, fuck. Well, like, Miss must really trust their friendship. Actually, so speaking of Raquel, Avery brings up this super interesting point, which I really liked to see discussed, which was everyone at this, well, the Ken and others are basically like 100% sure that like Musa is a problem and he needs to be killed.
Mm.
And Avery brings up the point that like Raquel is equally convinced of the opposite. And like we talked a bit about that when Raquel said that last week. But I really love how Avery ties this into one of the recurring threads of this chapter, which is the idea that in this world, you should never be 100% about anything.
Mm.
And I really like that she turns that here into this idea of like, we can't just write people off, like, you know, especially Raquel, maybe even Musa. Like, if we aren't willing to at least understand why they believe what they believe, then like, what are we doing? And I just really love that insight of like, it's a sort of first step to like, I think really defeating, like if you just kill Musa, you know, Reed will step into his place, like why has kind of done. It's like, you need to understand why the people like Reed and Raquel are doing what they're doing and at least be able to see where their point of view is coming from to be able to actually fight them effectively in a way that matters.
Mm, mm. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I understand Avery's point, but you just kind of have to, like, yeah. I am all for extending people as many chances as possible, but you have to draw the line somewhere, right?
No, yeah, of course. Like, I'm not saying that, like, I feel like Avery's real point here to me is not to, like, necessarily not do this, or maybe in Raquel's case it is, but, like, even for someone like Musa, I guess, I feel like the point is when you make this decision like this, it should come with, like, the thought of, like, understanding who he is, why he's doing this, and why you think this is the only option.
Mm.
Like, you know, you sort of need to understand them to be able to write off rehabilitation. And
sure,
I feel
sure.
pretty comfortable doing that in Abraham's case, to be honest.
Mm.
Rehabilitation seems very unlikely. but, like, without that understanding of, like, without that understanding of who he is, what his motivations are, and that belief that that means he's unrehabilitatable, I don't think you should be making decisions like, oh, we're going to kill him, I guess.
Yeah.
I just feel like that's kind of what Avery brings up here is like, yeah, sure, we're 100% sure, but like, so are they. Like, we need to at least understand them.
Mm.
And like, always, like you've got to keep questioning yourself, I think, as well. Like, that's probably the real point here is like, you know, maybe at a certain point in this fight, we actually do need to reevaluate whether killing even Abraham is a good idea. Because Zed does bring up some points about what it means for some wider powers, which my first instinct to those powers is if you're using him, then fuck yourself. But I don't know. I guess I'm worried by anyone who has that sort of conviction where they're not willing to question their position at any point.
Mm.
I feel like you should always be willing to at least hear the other side and like, question yourself. And then if you arrive at the answer of, oh, I was right, that's fine. But you got to genuinely be willing to, you know, question your assumptions and be like, oh, like, am I doing the right thing?
Yeah, 100%. But, you know, if we have the Kenneteers, the witch hunters, and the BHI practitioners as the three factions, you know, only the Kenneteers are willing to question their own side, right? Which is already an argument that makes me think that they're in the right. Like, yes, Avery, of course you should question yourself. They're not questioning themselves. And therefore, you know, you can try and take the high road there, but it's not going to change the things that need to happen.
I feel like the argument Avery makes in this point, and I admit now I need to go double check the context, but I feel like Avery is almost making the point here that that's what the Kennet others have just stopped doing.
Mm.
Like, they sort of immediately move to he has to die. And I guess Avery's, or they almost just come here saying, we're going to set the witch hunters on them. And they didn't even really think of contingencies for, the people like Reed and Raquel and stuff. And I suppose Avery's raising the point that maybe they haven't been stopping to question what they're doing enough.
Mm.
I agree the Kenneteers still do that plenty. It's why we love them. But, you know, with Rook helping call the shots, I worry that maybe the Kennet others aren't doing it as much as they should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also get a quick confirmation in this section. Avery and Snowdrop were going to talk to Toadstool about something. They decide not to.
Yeah.
So that gives me the impression that Snowdrop is planning on coming with.
Yes.
You know, maybe they're looking at some sort of shared custody deal, but I think this was just, like, unless we did miss it last week, this is the first confirmation we kind of have that Snowdrop is actually involved in this decision.
which is nice to know.
Yeah, because I think that was last week we came up with, hey, that hasn't come up at all yet.
And it's, a bit worrying. But thanks for putting this in, Wabo, so we know that Avery is not just kind of making this decision for Snowdrop, I suppose.
Yeah.
So Avery mulls over how this conversation went and has some realizations.
Yes. Obviously, the first one, which we've already talked about a little bit, is that Jabba might just be a big fat battery. And which is a very fun sort of reveal because it actually gives us nothing. Because all it tells us is that the plan can involve something big, but he's a power source for something else. Like, it's a reveal that kind of gives us nothing.
Mm. Yeah, it gives us the thought of, let's keep an eye on Jabba. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't actually answer any questions for us.
No, I suppose it rules out worrying about Jabba and, you know, tells us that there's the potential for it to be big, but, like, who knows what Jabba could be powering.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very glad that Avery has had this realization explicitly that, like, her thoughts about a relationship, in air quotes, fixing her, are unhealthy for her partner, for the relationship all around. It's just great. I loved it.
Yeah, this is really the major realizations he has here. All that stuff that's going to save lives with the conspiracy is fine, but, like, yeah, the big one is, as you say, finally seeing her process that, like, hey, this may not be healthy the way that I've built up, like, the need for a romantic relationship. Because she's sort of had that idea cross her mind recently and stuff, but this is the first time I think she really sits down and, like, mulls it over.
Mm.
And it's, it was just like, oh, fuck, thank God. And you're sort of starting to see her realize that what's happened is there was a point where she was alone and everyone kind of pulled away. And so she began to, like, you know, so she was wanting, she was yearning for any kind of love. And by escaping into fantasies, she started to build a version that wasn't a realistic goal. And, I mean, the fantastic thing about this story is that the great irony of that is the thing that pulled her out of her fantasy and made her realize that her relationship goals should be more realistic is the magic that lets her go to fantasy realms.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
And it feels like this feels like the big throw line of the chapter to me is Avery in this chapter is almost just going through a variety of situations where she, and I'm going to trigger a huge section of the Australian audience from New South Wales here. She's going through a bunch of situations where she belongs in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously her and Snowdrop as a pairing are, like, on fire this entire chapter. And then she spends like that time clearly just being good friends with Jess, Zed, and Bree. Then there's this hilarious prank that the goblins play on her with Jabba. And like, it's clearly such a good, like, healthy, friendly prank, because there's not ever a moment where Avery is like ashamed or embarrassed by what went down. Like, she almost immediately just kind of, as soon as she realizes what's going on, she's like, ha ha. And like, you know, Snowdrop's laughing, like Miss and Rourke are smiling in the background, Toad Swallow's going. Yeah. Like,
I mean, it is like, hilarious, in fairness.
I mean, it is, but like the fact that you can pull a prank like that, everyone's laughing, and even Avery's not like upset, just clearly shows how much she belongs with these guys and like trusts them. Like, she knows that there's no ill will. Like, if you're insecure in your position in the group here, you would take this a lot more personally and a lot harder.
Yeah.
And then obviously, like, she stands up against the Kennet others for the Blue Heron guys, which is definitely like this moment of like, she's so comfortable with both groups, she's willing to really stand for herself, which is not what we would have said about the start of the story, Avery. So it's like this whole chapter is her just like belonging in all these various circumstances with friends, having people around her who love her and have her back, and she has theirs. And it all sort of leads to her getting home at the end of the day and being like, the fuck am I wanting that's not this? Like, I have, she finally realizes that, what she's after, it doesn't really exist, because she has everything she actually needs. And it's just going to be a matter of, I guess, using those gold check marks to deprogram her brain from these fantasies she's been living in for so long now.
Avery meets up with the other Kenneteers, they catch up, and they plan to interrogate the Carmine Beast. I know, what a good way to end the chapter.
What a
isn't
cliffhanger.
It? It's so great. And it's like, it feels like the perfect way. Like, 100%, they're going to go in there, some crazy shit's going to happen, and there's going to be a big reveal, and that's going to be the end of arc 12. And that's going to kick off the grand finale, and things are going to get fucking crazy. And I'm just very excited for it.
Yeah, because like I've sat here for a bit now. I admittedly read this chapter quite late this week, so I haven't been sitting on it for too long. But I have been sitting here going, "What the fuck could we learn in the Carmine Alcazar that like blows shit sideways for arc 13?"
Here's what it is, Elliot: the Carmine Beast is involved somehow. Right. I've talked about this theory already, but I just think it so perfectly could be revealed by this. And I just think that will be so delightful.
I mean, but then the exact flavor of what that looks like is going to be, this is going to be a nuts sort of. You're right. I feel like we'll get this Alcazar quickly, end the arc, and then just Marissa Kerr will come early arc 13 and the shit will just pop off. Just the Alcazar-ing itself is going to be a wild ride. We already got some stuff set up by Zed about how they're going to be on very strict timers. And I mean, you know that if they're heading to a place made out of these furs, it's going to be fucking violent and wild. Like, this is going to be very fun.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like we're saying this every week now. We finally hit that end point of the story where every chapter ends and it's like, holy fuck, we have to wait 4 days for this.
Yeah, the story is just fucking amazing at the moment. Like, it's just so hype.
Yeah. As all the threads are starting to close, every single chapter's ending on a bit where I'm just like, oh, I can't believe I have to wait.
That's the end of these chapters. But it's not the end of our episode, Elliot, because it's time to revisit some Pale predictions.
Yeah, and actually, sorry, I wanted to mention earlier, but I forgot, when we were talking about all the Kennet others and all that, people should start, there's like no predictions, I think maybe there's like two or three, on what Marissica's plans for some of these Kennet others are. So like, if anybody has some big brain tinfoil, start submitting predictions on like how the new Kennet others are going to be used by Marissica, because there's a lot of room to get points, get credit for being the first person to pick stuff there. It's a very unexplored territory in our sheet. And we will be doing points and stuff during All Packed Up too. There may even be prizes. Okay, I suppose let's talk about this week's though.
Yes, let's do it.
So first up we have I'll do mine from Lapsed Classicist, of course. Probably the most common name we've brought up in these episodes. Lapsed Classicist prediction is essentially Musa will kill Cleo. They then go on to sort of elaborate basically about how Cleo's MO is very similar to Musa's. Like, they're both collecting trophies from defeated practitioners and sort of stealing their power. So there's a real sort of duology to them. And yeah, basically, you know, they might naturally gravitate towards each other as enemies. And I guess basically, after seeing that similarity, Lapsed Classicist has put their money on Musa rather than Cleo, which is probably fair. But also, they do say that, like, Musa killing Cleo could be something that helps the Kenneteers get closer to the rest of the Witch Hunters if they're the ones not killing Witch Hunters.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we'll see. But I think we spent like a bunch of time last week talking about how Cleo's collecting shit was like sick and twisted and reminded us of a practitioner. I don't think we actually tied it directly to Musa, and I can't believe we missed that. It's such a good pick.
Yeah, it is good. Like, Cleo as the Witch Hunter foil for Musa, so those two coming to blows soon enough. I think it's great. I also have a Cleo-related prediction, which I think is just because, before I get into this, like, narratively, Cleo is so interesting because she's so evil that, like, she feels like she's such an obstacle in the way of where we feel like the narrative should go, with the Kenneteers having a way to interact with the Witch Hunters and find some sort of common ground. So clearly, we and the audience as a whole want something to happen with Cleo that will kind of get her out of the way or explain that. I think that's why the Cleo theories are flying around a lot at the moment. Anyway, so Ghostly Bird, I've put out their prediction. They are saying the Witch Hunter not from the Lighthouse, Cleo, is Liz, which I just think is a very fun prediction. I don't know if I believe it, but I do appreciate how batshit crazy it is. Like, this outsider Witch Hunter, you know, we know Liz has dealt with Witch Hunters before, so it would kind of make sense. Yeah, I just think it's very batshit, and I think that's fun.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the tie between Liz and the Witch Hunters is going to be important when she makes her return.
Yeah.
Because, like, even Raph mentioned her. I love the idea she's impersonating one again. It almost feels too batshit crazy for it to be Cleo.
Yeah, maybe exactly. Maybe
that's why it's true. I guess the reason that doesn't feel right to me, though, is because she's meant to pull from people in the area. And Cleo does not feel even remotely similar to the rest of the Witch Hunters.
I mean, maybe Cleo is a mesh between, like, Musa and Elise or something, right?
Yes, yes.
Like,
oh god, you're making me start to believe this. This is bad.
I still don't really believe it, but I do like it, you know.
Yeah, no, I think I'm on the same page. I'm like, fuck, that feels good, but it can't, like, it's too wild.
So yeah, great predictions. If you have a prediction you want to leave, you can find the link to our Pale Predictor form in the show notes down below.
Yes, but we also have a discussion question to talk about this week, because it's been 2 weeks since we first asked everyone, how much does Charles have to atone for? What should his punishment look like?
Yeah, an interesting question, and we got a few answers, interesting answers. Although, I do think a few people basically have, most of our answers actually, have come up with the thought of any punishment Charles deserves, he is already serving out, basically.
Yeah, which I think I didn't expect anybody to argue against that point.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting. I've seen different levels of blame leveled at him for like how much he has to atone for since he's been forsworn. And I guess there's also obviously the hypothetical, what should his punishment have looked like? I really liked Vice Versailles' answer, in part because it feels very similar to my own opinion, which is, since he's been forsworn, or the exact quote that Vice Versailles had that I really liked was, since he's been forsworn, Charles is, in my opinion, agency exempt. He has none. And, like, that is exactly the page I'm on. Like, shit like the Hungry Choir, I essentially give him zero accountability for that. Like, there were parts of it that weren't great, like, you know, disturbing Yelda and all that. But I just think, given the circumstances, I find it, I can't hold any of it against him. So Vice Versa is sort of on a very similar page to me, which is that post forswearing, Charles doesn't have actually have anything to atone for. But they do mention that he had a pretty solid pattern of being a bit of a scumbag before he was forsworn. And it's like, so they're like, obviously the actual situation he was forsworn in, if that is true, is total bullshit. And he has nothing to atone for after that. But like, he definitely had stuff to answer for from his time, you know, working with various undergrounds, which I think is a very fair and valid point.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, we already know that Charles was on his own path of atonement before things got fucked up.
Yeah. Although, that's a great segue into Grundux 91's answer.
Yeah.
Because they brought up a really interesting point, which is, so just to sort of read out the quote, sadly, I don't think Charles can atone. The little we have of his background, which was he was fine to hang out with kids who broke into other people's homes so long as he benefited. Then he was summoning things for bad people because he was on the sidelines and he benefited. Then he started hanging out with the Blue Heron crowd. And even what we saw of him in Kennet was that he kind of allowed Edith to... Well, I guess he knew that Edith had the potential to be a problem is sort of the case that Grundux 91 is making here, which I think is arguable. But essentially what Grundux is saying is there is a clear pattern here of Charles being someone who, even when he's trying to do that the right thing, that usually involves him taking a step back and just helping different, not very good people. And so there's concerns about the fact of like what any sort of atonement for him can look like because he keeps making this mistake. And like, you know, with a pattern that deeply entrenched, you it's harder to write it off as like, oh, you're rehabilitated now. Like, yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't ever quite thought about his past like that in that way, but there's definitely a pattern there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know. I don't know if I put this much stock in it. Like, I do feel like, yes, the Hungry Choir kind of is emblematic of him slipping back into a problematic behavior, but it felt to me like Grundux is saying, like, because he made this mistake, it undoes the fact that he was trying to improve. You know what I mean? Like, the path to becoming better is not always in one direction. You sometimes do backslide, right? And so therefore, when he slipped back into this problematic habit during, you know, the lowest point of his life, I don't necessarily think that's that as much of a problem as Grundux seems to think it is, I guess.
Well, I think they're arguing all the stuff before he's forswearing. Like,
right.
You know, the stuff with Edith is like the stuff when we had the flashback in Edith's interlude, like where he sort of helped her and was like, oh, you're obsessed with Matthew. And she was like, yeah. And he was like, oh, okay. And didn't really do anything about it, I think is what Grundux is coming down on him for, I think is, yeah, that's maybe the one that's arguable. But yeah, I do think at the very least, this does raise a thing like, which came up in a few answers. Obviously, if you're aiming for something rehabilitatory in this universe, something that is quite handy is that you can have oaths you can make people swear to. And so, yeah, I guess with someone like Charles, I guess this is more evidence that whatever he's trying to, if you unforsworn him and setting him free on the world, you're going to have to put some restrictions or, you know, again, some sort of probation person who checks in on him and makes sure he's not repeating his mistakes.
I did like some of the things in Grundux's answer. I didn't come down as harsh on Charles as Grundux did, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. This was an opinion I absolutely disagree with, but I very much think is valid.
Yeah. Yeah, like, which is a great discussion question answer for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was like, this is very different to how I feel about where Charles should end up, but like, I see exactly what you mean. Like, I guess Grundux gets the impression from the way Charles defends a lot of his stuff, including the fact that the Carmine Beasts twisted the Hungry Choir stuff against him. He's continuously not taking enough responsibility for his role in the bad stuff that happens. I think when we saw him in his dream, he seemed to be wearing certain parts of it very heavily on himself, but there probably is a valid argument that there are some things that he's helped do in the past that he isn't taking enough responsibility for. And like the Carmine, like I don't think it's fair, but I could see why people would think the Carmine, oh, so not the Carmine, the Hungry Choir is one of them.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So finally, we had a response from David L. Hunt. David L. Hunt is talking about the design of what the Hungry Choir was originally going to be, this Red Heron inveiglement, which is still very funny. It was a very... It was very kind of emotionally involved and personal to Charles, and he's possibly overselling how noble his goals were. And the punishment that he probably needs is, you know, some sworn oaths to guarantee him improving.
Yeah, I think I really like David's answer with that one part. I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but like it's true that like Charles did sort of say, no, this was going to be fair because it was all like just targeting selfish practitioners. But then he did start talking about like, oh, and this part was going to lure in Bristow and this would lure in Ray. And it's like, you're talking about your noble goals, but there's a huge section of this that is extremely personal to the people who didn't help you when Alexander did this, which, yeah, suggests that he's maybe, at least in his own mind, or just lying when he says it, like overselling how noble the whole thing was. And I think that that's actually probably pretty spot on.
Yeah. The quote that I really liked from David's answer was, thinking about punishments, David said, that part is much more difficult. I'm of the opinion that forswearing is already in the nobody deserves that category, and any form of punishment should be, by definition, something that makes his situation worse, which I just think is a great quote of like, yeah, I don't think anyone deserves to be forsworn, and so therefore... there's no punishment that he should have that you know, that would be, I don't know, like equal or responsible in response to something that he's done, when like the life he leads now is so far beyond what I think the minimum standards of living should be, even for, you know, a criminal, right?
I want to push. I want to push back on the idea that. Well, actually, sorry, no. I do think that punishment is something that should definitionally make your, like, situation worse. So, I guess this is a semantic argument about punishment, I guess. I don't know. Like, for me, I don't think the point of punishment should have anything to do with making their situation worse. Like, for me, it's all about rehabilitation. Like,
sure, but that's, yeah, that's not what a punishment is, right?
Yeah, maybe it's poor wording in the question then. Because, yeah, like, I don't know. Like, for me, you know, you think about, see a lot of stuff about, you know, in some of those, like, Nordic countries, how they got the really nice prisons because they're very focused on rehabilitation. Like, for me, it's like, you know.
100% I agree with you about rehabilitative justice systems, for sure. But talking about punishment explicitly, like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess, like, when I'm, yeah, I'm thinking more along the lines of, like, the other thing David mentioned, which is, yeah, those, like, oaths. Or whatever, to try and guarantee that he improves. Like, I would still consider that a punishment. Maybe I'm using the word wrong, but like, I don't think that is necessarily making his life worse. But yeah, anyway, I don't know. I really liked David's idea of, like, I feel like, and some other people said it as well, but like, using the fact that this world has oaths that people have to stick to is a good idea. Except also that means if they break them, then they end up forsworn, which kind of puts us back at square one.
Yeah.
Like, if Charles has another fuck up, does he deserve to be forsworn? Like, the oaths only have power as long as being forsworn is the punishment. It's a bit of a catch 22 with that one.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks everyone who left us a discussion question response. Always enjoy reading them.
Yes. Now, we always leave coming up with the discussion question till the last minute because.
Then we get to know what's going to be most relevant to the chapters once we've been kind of doing our notes on them and stuff.
No, we need to take Zed's advice and just prioritize better. anyway, we find it quite hard. So anyway, we couldn't think of one last minute. So this fortnight, we're just going to do a mailbag. So we'll answer your questions instead because we couldn't think of one. So yeah, I guess post those in the Reddit thread. You can email them to us, you know. If we see it, we'll answer it, I guess.
Yeah. So I think Reddit thread is probably the place that we'll check actively, but also email us if you want at mediumdpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's still our email. Okay, cool. or leave your questions in our discussion thread, which you will find linked in the show notes down below.
Yep. Don't forget to, you know, give us a review on your podcasting platform of use. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, well, good reviews, hopefully, lead to, you know, this podcast getting out there, which means Pale gets out there, which means more people read Pale. And at the end of the day, if you're still listening to this podcast, like 100 episodes in, you probably want that too.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, why don't you check out the website, the Duff Media website, duffmedia.com. There's all kinds of great things on there. There's fun little games that you can play. There's secrets. And there's links to all the other great shows.
It's been a while since you pulled that blatant Y out for the outro.
It just cracks me up every time. The idea of the Duff Media website being like a Neopets-esque thing where you collect Duff Media hosts and use them to play in various Wild Bow or OC-themed games. Anyway, all the other links to the Duff Media shows can be found there, as well as all the other stuff that's going on the network. You know what it is. It's exciting. Go check it out if you need to find it. Duffmedia.com.
Yep, and you know that's where all the info on the fan art contest will be revealed. But if you want to see it before then, before like next week, hop on over to Patreon and sign up so you can help vote.
Elliot, have we? I know that you mentioning Patreon was a great opportunity for me to segue to talking about the Patreon. But before we get to that, have we mentioned the game jam for All Packed Up yet? All Packed Up 2, sorry. Have we talked about that yet?
I don't think so, but honestly, I haven't kept very good track of what we have and haven't blogged.
So one of the segments that we did for the first 24-hour live stream was a game jam, a packed-themed game jam, and we're planning on doing that again. We already kind of know what the game that we're going to create is, but we'll see.
But this time it'll be a Pale one. It's not going to be a Pale.
Well, yes, obviously. So what that means, Elliot, is if it goes well enough, we can put that game on the Duff Media website and then finally that thing won't be a lie anymore. So that'll be fine. Maybe we can have like a choose your character and we can have a little 8-bit sprite art of, you know, oh, do you want to be Elliot? Do you want to be Ruben? Do you want to be, I don't know, Scott or Alexandra or Jenny or whoever, you know? I think that would be fun. Anyway.
Do you remember how the last game jam was?
Yes. And yeah, it ran from, you know, midnight until 4 a.m. or something, so it was a bit of a mess. If you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/duffmedia. You get access to all kinds of cool things, my favorite of which is, of course, all the great bonus shows that you get at the $5 a month tier. $10 a month tier. Thanks, Elliot. Yeah, all kinds of absolutely wonderful bonus shows, including one that we do that is my favorite show to record. And I'm so excited for the next episode that we've got coming out. So become a patron and you get to check that out.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun one. While you're on Patreon, don't forget to stop by patreon.com/Wabo. If you're already a patron, up it. If you're not, get on it. That way he keeps writing. We keep getting stories. You know, if you don't want Pale to end, keep giving him money and then maybe he'll just keep writing Pale forever.
Stay tuned to the end of the show for the terms and conditions of that lie. Anyway, thanks folks for joining us and we'll see you next time.
See ya.